This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week is Nick White, comic book contributor for the site, and a special guest friend of the podcast, James Hahn. Thank you guys for being with me this week. James, you're new to the podcast. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Because last time we had someone on, we waited like 25 minutes before we intro'd them, and I feel really bad. So what got you into comic books, man? Why are you here? What brings you to us this week?
Well, I've been reading comic books for a long time. I took a break probably about 10 years after high school, and then I started getting into them more recently just because I think of the large amount of independent content that's being produced, and a lot of really unique stories are being put out there that I don't think were being put out maybe even when I was younger.
Cool. Yeah, so you know, thanks for being on the podcast this week. I realize that, like, you've been talking to me for, I don't know, we've known each other for quite a while now. We knew each other through college and stuff. And, you know, I feel like at one point I just said, man, you got to read comic books, because that's pretty much what I say to everybody. So what are you into right now? I mean, like, usually when we start this show, we talk about, you know, what comic books are reading, but what are you reading right now? We'll talk to you, and then Nick and I will tell you about, or we'll comment and make fun of you or whatever, for whatever you're reading.
Well, I think when you were talking to me in college, you were pretty much doing the usual X-Men type conversation.
Yeah, that sounds like me, yeah.
And I don't really go for the superhero stuff as much, so I kind of started looking into my own stuff. Talking about what I'm reading specifically right now, Nameless is probably one of my favorite series out there by Grant Morrison, Chris Burnham. I think that's a really interesting series. Grant Morrison just has this really good mind for talking about really fucked up stuff.
Yeah, I'd say that's true.
And the most, like, bizarre, mind-fucky, like, I don't even know what's going on. Is this reality? Is this just an imagination? I don't even know.
Grant Morrison's asking himself the same questions.
Yeah.
As he takes more acid.
Yeah.
So what else have you been, so you're like into the Nameless, or you into, like, I guess the Nameless is still being published, right? That's, I don't know if that's ended. Yeah. I don't read that book, but okay.
Yeah, number 5 is coming out in a couple weeks here.
Okay, cool. What else have you been reading lately?
Airboy, which is a very interesting comic by Robinson and Hinkle. Basically, the premise of Airboy is just these two authors who are supposed to write about this old comic book hero, Airboy, who's kind of a goofy guy. They go and do a bunch of drugs and fuck some hookers. And then they show up. Oh, yeah. I mean, I assume that's the creative process, right?
Right.
And then they end up in Airboy's world, and they start... He's obviously very judgmental of their lifestyles, because he's kind of like a Superman-type character, the Boy Scout-type guy.
Okay.
And the authors are just, like, drinking and having a great time. So it's kind of like a moral battle, like, nobody really knows what's going on exactly.
Okay. I've heard a lot about this book. I've never actually read it, but mostly all the news that I've heard is about all sorts of controversy regarding the creators and their disrespect towards people. I don't know. I've heard, like, really, like two sides of the same, of this story, where it's like people are like, this is a really, really good comic book because of X, Y, and Z, and other people are saying this is a really bad comic book because of some negative connotations and things that they've thrown into the book. So I don't know. I'm kind of torn, but I am looking forward to probably getting it in trade. Nick, have you read this book or heard anything about this book at all?
Yeah, I've read the first issue, and that was... It was very interesting. It was very much like a weird sort of meta commentary on sort of making comics. Because, I mean, James sort of touched on this briefly, but the whole motivation is that this Airborne character has gone public domain. And so they're really encouraged to make the comic because now he's sort of a public character. And Eric Stevenson, I believe that's his name, the guy in charge of Image, the one who writes Nowhere Men, he's depicted in the comic as well, and he's like sort of pushing
he's
James
technically
Robinson.
Their publisher. I mean, he's not in charge of Image. I mean,
okay.
I push up my nerd meta glasses really quick. Hold on.
Hey, I did cite Nowhere Men, so it's not like I'm, you know, totally unaware of what's going on, but he sort of comes to Robinson and is like, yeah, this character's public rights. I think it would be really interesting to sort of reinvent him, which of course is something that you're seeing at a lot of the publishers these days. And Robinson goes through all these talks about all these weird, like, personal struggles he's been having and how he feels he's not the writer he used to be. And it really starts to oddly blur the line where you start asking yourself how much of the Robinson in this book is, like, autobiographical, how much of it is a comical exaggeration, how much of it is completely falsified. And it turns into, like, a weird meta-discussion over, like, truth and depiction. And, of course, I don't know where the series goes from there. Like James said, it delves more into Airboy and whatnot. But I thought the first issue was pretty clever. But, yeah, it definitely... It gets away with the sorts of things you would only see in an Image book. And that is probably all that can be said on that topic.
And gotcha. A lot more penises than you would expect.
A lot, yeah. Airboy number one pretty much makes it very clear in terms of what you're getting into.
There's a full page spread of just them being sandwiching this hooker between them when they're like about to pass out off of. I think they were snorting cocaine and maybe heroin. I'm not sure.
Multiple drugs were used. Yes.
Sure.
But like I said, it turns into this weird discussion and debate over like how much of this is based in reality, because it's like the instinct is to go, well, none of it, right? That's just ridiculous. But then you start to wonder.
Right. Well, yeah, so Nick, I guess, James, is anything else you've been reading, I guess? Or Nick, what have you guys been, I don't know, what else have you guys been reading?
Well, I would have to say It Will All Hurt. Okay. I couldn't name the creators offhand, but I think
That's Darrenpole who did The Wrenchies, right?
The Wrenchies, yep.
Yep, okay.
That one is just... I mean, it's similar to the Wrenchies in that it's sort of this, like, weird acid trip where it starts out in issue one. There's just this girl wandering
Spoil it all.
I won't spoil it. Okay. But basically, there's this huge wasteland, and everyone is... It's kind of a post-apocalyptic type world, and there's all these, like, weird monsters and shit chasing you around. And they all have to basically gang up against this, like, red wizard or something like that.
Sure.
And it's basically just the story of all these, like, random people. They always have very interesting characters in these. Just wandering around. Eventually, they all team up. They have to fight this huge monster or whatever.
But the title implies that there's just something awful and depressing about the book. Like, The Wrenchies was kind of like a superhero-esque story. And even the title implied that in the cover. Whereas, like, It Will All Hurt... I have issues 2 and 3, which is why I'm saying don't spoil it, because I need to have a copy of issue 1 coming to Wii on Monday. But It Will All Hurt implies like some deep, depressing shit. I guess is that
something
is there any
inevitable
kind of focus
and
like
bad
that?
Is coming?
Yeah.
Well, I think the difference between Wrenchies and It Will All Hurt is Wrenchies kind of has this interesting dimension where you're not really sure if what's happening is reality for these characters or not, or if it is an imagination. With It Will All Hurt, you are certain that this is their reality and life is just shit for them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, Nick, what have you been reading this week?
I actually finally got around to doing some much needed bagging and boarding, and that finally allowed me to get around to some much needed reading to clear up some space. So I think I read Ninjak, I read The Disciples, Gotham by Midnight, some Grayson, pretty much everything. I read a little bit of everything. Disciples was pretty good. Really interested to see where that goes. Black Mask books are, as we've said before, definitely the ones to be paying attention to.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, I read my single issue comics, my physical books. I haven't read any of my digital books. Like, I've got Fresh Romance number 4 sitting in my Comixology, like, list of things to read, and I'm just like, I don't know if you guys have read this or heard of this book at all. It's like a digital-only, I think, subscription magazine where it's like an anthology series where each issue is $5, but it comes with 3 stories in it. Kind of similar to, like, The Island in a way, but The Island is obviously a much bigger thing. But nonetheless, Fresh Romance is this book that I backed on Kickstarter because it sounded cool. It sounded like a breath of fresh air, which I've kind of been needing, and I think Archie and this book have really given me the breath of fresh air that I've needed. And it's really cool. I haven't read it yet, so I haven't read number 4, but 1 through 3 was really good, and all the little stories they're doing are really interesting and fun. There's a story about I think I have to go back to and reread issues 1-3 because the story is kind of all over the place. But there are people in this city. It's kind of, it feels like Archie in a way, where there's people with magic and people without magic, and the people with magic aren't supposed to like mate with the people who don't have magic. And yet there's like this guy, and there's a love triangle between this guy and these two girls, and in the sense that like the two girls kind of are together, but they both like the same guy, and I don't know where the guy sits on the whole thing. It's really a little confusing, especially given the anthology format where I'm reading story after story after story, and then I follow up the next month with the same thing. So nonetheless, it's like a lot of things are really cutesy, and there are a lot of like really positive and optimistic stories about people of all sexes and genders getting together and being happy and in love, and the struggles we have, like in, I guess, like romantic politics of things and the implications of society on us as people who are dating and all this stuff. It's really good. I enjoy it. But I haven't read that yet. So instead, this week I read Mouse Guard Fall 1152 and Copra Volume 1. Copra, which is this... it's this story created by a guy who lives here in New York, published by a very small publisher called Bergen Street Press, which is also here in New York and Brooklyn. And it's like an action superhero story about these delinquent superheroes who go on suicide missions. And it sounds like Suicide Squad in a way, and it feels like the whole story should have been a Suicide Squad story that just never got picked up.
Oh, jeez.
And it's really good, though. Like, I read through the first volume, and it is way out there. It does things with comics that can only be done with comics. Like, there is so many comic-only things that are in this book that I can't describe them to you. I highly implore you to go out and spend the money on this book. It is worth every single penny, just for how kind of reminds me of Transformers versus G.I. Joe in a way, where they're doing things that are just humongous on the page that you couldn't do in any other medium. And it's action-packed, and it's got like these weird superhero narratives, and you really don't know too much about all these characters, but by the end you have a very strong grasp on what these people, like their sense of morality and what they want out of this big mission that they're going on at the end. It's really, really good. So I read that, and then I started reading Understanding Comics finally for the first time in my life. And if you don't know what Understanding Comics is, it's a book by Scott McCloud written in 1993, I believe, all about what comic books are, like how we view them as a society, what they are capable of doing, and everything you ever wanted to know about comics is in this book. And it's incredibly dense. I thought I could tackle it all in a sitting. I was so wrong. I got through 2.5 chapters, and I had to put it down just to decompress and watch some TV and just like kind of realize that there was so much going on in that book. I really, really enjoyed it.
And now when you look at comics, it's like those graphical things in A Beautiful Mind. You just see all of like the, you know, graphics floating in the air and everything, and you're like, yes. I understand everything.
I understand what the pencils do now. I understand what the dialogue is now. Yeah.
And then you get distracted really cool. And leave a baby in a bathtub, and then... Go yeah, to meet Ed Harris in the woods.
How do you know what I do on my weekends? Nick, stop.
Yeah, sorry. Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had a kind of similar experience with Hip Hop Family Tree. Is that a book you guys read?
No, but I've been meaning to. It's on my list. It's on my list of things to buy. I want to buy that book in physical form just because of how beautiful it looks.
Yeah, you got to. And I got Volume 1, and I'm having the same problem where there's so much information on every page, and it's clear that the guy is like obsessively researching every single detail. Like every panel is a fact that you can look up about some guy who's you probably never even heard of.
And it's all just about like the origins of hip-hop in America, right?
Yeah, it goes through all like the big names that you probably would read in a book if you read a book about it. So it's almost like encyclopedic.
That's so cool. Yeah, that book in theory just impresses me, let alone, I mean, the little bits that I've read, like the Free Comic Book Day stuff that I've read, it's amazing. I really want to get a hold of that book, like have it and feel it in my hands.
I just feel the need to take notes. Like, I need to look up all of these people now.
Yeah, if you really want to get into hip-hop, like, that's the way to do it, right? Give someone this graphic novel and say, hey, man, you don't know anything about hip-hop, and make them read it.
Ooh, I don't know if I'd lead with that, but okay. Excuse me, was you saying something? You can't tell me nothing. You can't tell me
nothing. You can't tell me nothing. Let's talk about our comic picks for this week, since, you know, we like to also talk about what's coming out this week. So, Nick... This week, your pick is Imperium number 8. What are you excited about in this book? You know, I haven't actually read any of this book yet. I have seven issues, and I haven't read any of it.
Oh, my God. Oh, jeez. Arc 2 is nearly done, and you haven't even touched it.
Arrgh. I know. I feel like every time I talk to you about this book, I need to add another two issues that I won't read.
Oh, jeez. That makes... Oh, man.
But you're excited about this book this week. Why?
I am.
Are you excited about?
One of us is. It was kind of down to this, and I'm getting the Alien Salvation hardcover as well. So I know we usually don't count trades, but I'm just gonna quick name drop that.
Yeah, we do sometimes.
Yeah. So it's an oversized one shot. It's Dave Gibbons writing, Mike Mignola on art, and Matt Hollingsworth on colors. So
what?
How is that not going to be amazing?
That sounds pretty stacked.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, this was
Dave Gibbons is writing.
Yep.
Mike Mignola is on art.
Yep.
And Matt Hollings was, what the fuck?
Yep.
Okay, sorry, that blows my mind.
It was a oversized one shot, originally published in 93. So if you're really motivated, you can go actually read it before I even do, if you wanted to. But really pumped for that in addition. But yeah, Imperium number 8. Still in the second arc, we still have Dysart writing, Scott Eaton on pencils, who's probably best known for... He recently did the Arkham War miniseries tie-in to Forever Evil. And what we're encountering in this issue and what I'm really excited about is that Toyo Harada, who's sort of viewed as the bad guy in the Valiant universe, just for a really basic primer, Imperium is really about Toyo Harada more or less creating a squad of bad guys. It's more or less the opposite of a Justice League. He's just, creating a squad of baddies. And he spends most of the first arc recruiting people. But in the second arc, he gets this very misguided idea that he apparently wants to add this relatively new character to the Valiant universe called Divinity on his team. And Divinity recently had a miniseries, to keep things very brief. Divinity was this guy in the Soviet Republic and in the USSR in the 60s, and they sent him off into deep space during the whole space race, and his all records of him were scrubbed. They just sent him into deep space, no idea what was going to come back or if anything was going to come back. And he comes back with these crazy insane powers, with the ability to sort of really distort time and space, and create these very real illusions. And really what he tends to do for people, he's not super evil, but there are a lot of people who come after him and try to hunt him. Understandably, all these different government forces try to get him originally. And he's able to give them all these illusions of what they've always wanted in life. Like this one guy's wife dies, and so he brings her back. And anyway, Harada comes after him because he's an idiot and thinks he can pull this off. And issue 7 was almost sort of comical because Divinity, every time Harada gets close, Divinity basically just beams him off into a different place, a different point in time and space. And then Harada has to figure out his bearings again, because Harada sends him back 5 minutes in time, and then he sends him back 2 days in time. he keeps just messing with him. But again, let's not forget, Harada is super powerful. He's this crazy, he's got all of those telepathic psionic abilities, and at the end of the issue it's implied that Harada has finally figured out how he's going to stop this endless recursive loop. It almost feels, the issue almost comes across like Groundhog's Day, honestly, and it's very oddly funny in that way. And it implies that he's finally figured it out, and he's going to actually basically force Harada to force Divinity to join his team. We'll see how well that works. Especially considering that everyone else has joined of their own free will, and Divinity just wants to be left alone. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So James, if you have no idea what's going on in the Valiant universe, you may be a little lost here. But
I have a limited knowledge.
Okay. Yeah, the Valiant universe is very robust, despite how, I guess, new it is. And Nick is very much obsessed, that's all.
Yeah, I've been really meaning to get into it. I have, there's a trade called The Valiant that I read
Yes. Yep.
And then
that's a very good one.
That's a great jumping on point. Yeah.
And then I've been collecting all the Book of Death stuff, although I pretty much have no idea what's going on in that, but it's still interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Valiant was much more new reader friendly than Book of Death. And mm-hmm. are you reading the one shot tie-ins to Book of Death, or just strictly
I've been picking those up too.
Ooh, okay. See, Book of Death is definitely more approachable.
Oh no, now we've opened the can of worms. Sorry. Oh, no.
I'm just gonna warn you. Book of Death is much more approachable than the one shots, but Valiant is still always very well known for, even with most issues, even issues in the middle of an arc or whatever, they still try as hard as they can to make a jumping on point. Or they'll have, like, two paragraphs at the beginning of the issue that sort of summarize things up to that point, which, of course, is mm-hmm. something Marvel does as well, but DC has never, at least recently, hasn't taken an interest in that, so...
They tried it once, and then it backfired. But...
Yeah.
that's another story. So, yeah, that's... No, Imperium sounds great. I need to read it. That's what it comes down to.
How does Mike Mignola have the time for all these things?
No, Mike Mignola is on the Alien book,
yes.
Right? Yeah, Okay.
Scott Eaton is on the art for Imperium.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, that was a little confusing there for a second too. Yeah, for me too. So, anyway, so James, what's your pick for this week?
Plutona number one.
Okay.
So, I don't really know too much about it. I know who Jeff Lemire is, and I'm sure that you guys know who he is too.
Yeah.
Basically, the premise that I know up to this point is that five young suburban kids walk into the woods and they see the body of Plutona, who's the most powerful superhero in the world. So, yeah, what? I mean...
That's okay. about all I know, too. Yep.
So who's publishing this book?
It's Image.
Yeah, this is Image. Yep.
Okay. So this is, like, okay, I wasn't sure if this was tied into anything at all, but okay. And so is it like a, do we know if it's going to be like a coming of age story, or do you know if it is it just like about these kids and how they react to it?
I think it's going to be coming of age, definitely. I think it's going to have to do a lot with relationships of people. It also has art from Emmy Lennox, who I think is new. This will be your first comic, so that'll be interesting too.
Interesting. Cool. How's the art look for you from the previews? I assume there's some sort of preview or at least a cover art or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it looks good to me. Jeff Lemire always seems to have at least an influence on the art in his books. I don't know if you guys could talk more about that, but...
Yeah, Nick's got a little bit of an obsession. I keep pointing fingers at Nick like he's a bad person. Like he's just the person that's better at this than me, I guess. So.
Oh, jeez. No. I am a pretty big Jeff Lemire or Lemire fan. Everything from... Sweet Tooth to his Green Arrow run, which for me might honestly be, I know he's done a lot of other things that are definitely worthy of praise, but his Green Arrow run was just amazing. And you're right, he does tend to pair himself with artists that either have kind of his cartooning approach, and I think that's what you're seeing in Plutonia or whatever it is. Plutona. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, he does tend to pair himself. Even when he's working with a big two publisher, he's not afraid, whether or not he has any input into this, I don't know, to pair himself with people that are sort of unconventional or not what you'd consider normal comic booky artists. He's always searching for sort of who he thinks would be best for the job. Like Travel Foreman with Animal Man, I'm still amazed DC said okay to Travel Foreman, because Travel Foreman's art is weird. It is weird.
Well, Animal Man's pretty weird as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the whole story is out there, yeah.
But, and Andrea Sorrentino with Green Arrow, I know a lot of people thought his artwork was super bizarre there and really odd, but now that Sorrentino's over at Marvel doing Old Man Logan, apparently now he's, you know, the bee's knees or whatever, but, yeah.
It's like the new Steve McNiven or something.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
But, yeah, you're absolutely right. Lemire does tend to pair himself up with... really unique artists, and I would say people that usually fit the tone of the books perfectly. Dustin Nguyen on Descender is another amazing example of that.
Yeah, that's another one I could put as my pick as well. Descender, I'm very excited for the next one.
Oh no, don't you break the rules too. Don't you dare break the rules and pick two books. I'll start fighting somebody. I will fly back to Michigan and punch someone in the face. No,
it's one pick. It's just one.
It is just one. No. Which is why my pick this week is Lazarus number 19. Ooh. Because quite honestly, my picks for this week weren't humongous. I was going to pick Material number 4, but I think I've picked Material every month that it's come out. Or at least someone has. So I should probably not do that. And get away from my secret obsession with Ellis Cott. But Lazarus 19, if you're not reading Lazarus, then this probably has no... Just like Imperium, probably, this may have no bar on what you think. But Lazarus is the greatest comic book being published right now, I think, in many, many ways, in terms of structure of story, in terms of world-building events. World-building alone, this is probably the greatest comic book out there. And
I don't know. You guys hyped Transformers versus G.I. Joe pretty big last podcast, I believe.
Okay. Well, Transformers versus G.I. Joe is a whole different animal because it's not so much about world building so much as it is about rolling with all of the punches that you get and just kind of realizing that something that happens 3 pages ago may not have any effect on the rest of the story, despite how monumental it seemed for that page. Where Lazarus, on the other hand, Rucka has been building this world since page one and in the back matter of every book. And we say this every week or every month that it comes out if someone picks this book. But there is a level of espionage. There's action. There's suspense. There's drama. There's like everything you want out of a very, very good comic book. And Michael Lark's art is top notch. It's every single month is better than last month. And it's unbelievable. This book is so fantastic in so many different ways in terms of telling a great story and like seeing the consequences of some small part of a story play out over a larger world and seeing actions and events happen from multiple perspectives. It is, as I've said, it is probably the best world-building book out there because you are getting a full-fledged story. You're not just getting point-of-view story. You're getting story from multiple facets in this world. Seeing how when somebody goes and they kill a bunch of people, you know, to try to make a political point, you see the reaction from the enemy side, from the side that won, from the side of the people that were just collateral damage. Even more so, you see, you know, the reaction from people that aren't even involved in the conflict and are affected by the conflict, but they still have, you know, relevance to the story. This is a humongous book. I want this to go on for 100,000 issues. It's so good. I know that Greg Rucka and Michael Lark probably can't do that. And if we get to 60, I think that'll probably be the good stopping point or something. But man, this is one of those books that I have no qualms recommending to somebody who's looking for a good story, like a solid story. I think you could hand this to anyone who likes espionage, anyone who likes action, anyone who likes drama, and they will totally love this book. And sci-fi. Like, let's not forget the sci-fi aspect of this, because there is some very near-future sci-fi stuff that happens in this book. Like, the idea of longevity in life and people's like use of drugs to do things to fix themselves or make people sick or using biochemical warfare, all that stuff. This book has everything. Like, I can't think of a topic they haven't covered yet in a way. I mean, obviously they can't cover everything. They're not going into the historical implications of something like this, but you know, they do cover everything that you would want out of a very, very good story, a very robust story. So Lazarus, go pick up volume one. It's $10. If you don't like it, this is another one of those books that I will gladly send you $10 if you don't like it, just to pay you back for that book. So soapbox, step off. Yeah. Are you guys reading this book? Nick, I think you're reading this book, right?
I read it in trade, yeah. And so I'm technically through the third trade.
Okay.
That's the arc when you first sort of really see, I think, all of the, or at least a large amount of the families sort of finally meeting together for that big, like, gala, that big sort of, like, there's like a dance and the formal dinner and all that other stuff. It's just, the two words that I always think of with that book is it's grounded. It's so grounded. It's grounded in ideas of what a possible kind of post-apocalyptic future might be. It's very grounded in science. It's very grounded in sort of political discourse and how countries interact with each other and national policy. But it's also very engaging at the same time.
Right.
There's so many different personal narratives going on and so many players and a lot of books where you get a huge ensemble cast, you always get a little bit I tend to roll my eyes because I'm always like, which characters are inevitably going to just prove to be irrelevant or not really be a big deal. But in this, you have to keep your eyes on everybody because they will come back. Like, yeah. They will eventually play into the book. And you were hinting at this a bit, but you're right. A lot of the time, it's sort of when there's an action or one country, not really a country, I should say a family. One family does something against another family. You're always looking at the aggressor and you're looking at the victim, but really, you're always paying attention to sort of all these other countries off to the sides and trying to always watching whether or not they are going to jump to the defense of their other families that they've made promises to. In a lot of ways, it reminds me of World War One, where you had all of, you know, each country was like, well, this country fought that country, so we've got to back up our, you know, we've got to back our horse. And then, you know, behind them is a bigger country that's like, well, they went to war, so we've got to help them out. And so you're always juggling all these different parties. And yeah, it's a fantastic read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
James, absolutely. Have you read this at all?
Oh, yeah. I have the first two trades. Really, any book that has that concept of humanity, like the main character, not good with the name, but she's the Lazarus for the main family. And you're always kind of wondering, like, is she actually a human being? Like, and I think that's a big issue with all the family members, kind of question like whether they have to respect her as a member of the family or if she's just like this tool that they're using.
Yeah, that's a question that I think is brought up throughout the whole book. It's so wonderful. Like, I mean, not the question itself, but like that question, that the fact that question is there, because I as a reader, I feel like Forever is a person. I mean, we're obviously getting her side of the story, but yet that question still lingers. It is always there. Like, someone is always bringing it up about not just Forever, but all the other Lazari, I guess you would call them.
Right.
And it begs the question, like, you know, Forever sees herself as the daughter of her father, and she has her brothers and sisters, and she's treated as a family member except for ... Like, that's kind of how the book always plays it out. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, so, all right, we're going to take a quick break before we continue to ramble on about how great this book is. It's wonderful how I always happen to pick the last book, and it's always the best every week. no, I'm kidding. Yeah, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna chat about some topics with genre books and reading comic books in public. So we'll be back in just a minute.
I would say probably about 80 to 90% of the comic books I pick up are all horror based. I started out reading superhero comics just like the rest of us, and slowly began to realize that that's just kind of a cliche genre and is a bit played out. Not always the most interesting characters, because I mostly was reading actual, you know, fiction books, not comic books, when I was taking that 10-year break or so. So, horror, for me, is just a fascinating genre that I've been really interested in the past couple of years, particularly with movies. And comics have this very interesting issue where, in a horror film, if you're shown the monster, like, straight out, you're probably not going to be afraid of that monster anymore for the rest of the movie. With comic books, they have to at least show you kind of a piece of the monster just because of the nature of the medium, and so they have to really come up with these very interesting concepts to really, like, disturb you and bother you. Not necessarily, like, the image. I mean, gore, obviously, you can get that anywhere, but the really interesting horror ones are more of that psychological aspect. So what do you guys have to say about horror books? Are you reading any at all?
I tend to walk away from horror books, not in the sense that I don't want to necessarily read
walk
them,
or
but
run.
I, well, it's a light gallop away. I'm not really a big fan of horror books, mostly because I'm a huge scaredy cat. Like, in such a way, like, I didn't for a long time. I would read, you know, the horror book that I was reading most often was Walking Dead, and that's a horror book in the sense that it's a zombie book. and, you know, bad shit happens, and there's a whole psychological aspect to it, and all that jazz. And there was gore, even though it's in black and white. And that book didn't necessarily scare me, but, you know, I started reading something like Crossed back when it was coming out originally, and that, like, weirded me the fuck out, because it was gore, and it was nasty, and it was that level of, like, extreme violence that kind of disturbs you on, like, a different level than just seeing, like, someone getting shot in, like, a superhero comic. So, I don't know. I tend to stray away from them just because they're not my bag. Like, they rub me the wrong way, and it's not something that I'm necessarily comfortable with. I don't know.
Well, I feel like that's what horror comics are trying to do, right? They're trying to bother
right.
you.
Right, but I mean, just like in horror movies, isn't there like a level of like adrenaline rush that you're supposed to get out of them by being scared and saying, oh, no, I'm really scared, but no, it's not real, haha, this is fun, mm-hmm. like excitement. Whereas with superheroes, with horror comics, it just weirds me out, and I'm like, maybe there is a virus that's going to make everyone want to kill each other, or maybe there is a supernatural alien that's going to come out of the sky and kill me by putting, you know, a little worm in my body or something. I don't know. That was an alien reference. I don't know. It was really weak. So
it's okay.
I'm
still scared.
Yeah, so I kind of stray away, but I don't know. I used to try. I was trying to read a bunch of Avatar Press stuff for a little while, and that's like the go-to horror publisher for me. And it's just not my thing. That's all. What about you, Nick?
Yeah, I would have to admit, I do read a decent amount of horror books. Like I told you before, and I'm sure I've said it on this podcast a couple times, I did write my senior thesis for college on Lovecraft, and so I'm a huge fan of his. I'm a big fan of cosmic horror, the idea that a lot of the things that might scare us, we either don't understand, or we can't really see them, or mm-hmm. we don't really, we might maybe see the, like the underlings or the little, you know, henchmen or whatever of whatever bigger plan is going on, but we don't understand on a massive universe or cosmic or temporal or chronological level what's really going on. And the whole idea there is that man is so ignorant that he can't even understand how bad things are. And if he would go insane. And of course, that's the whole basic premise on which most Lovecraft literature rests.
So you were a really big fan of Interstellar then, right?
Oh, no.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Right. Man, if only man knew how bad things really were.
In the fifth dimension.
If only man knew that Matt Damon was waiting on a planet to choke him out. exactly. So I do read some more traditional, I would say what's more traditional stuff. I read Harrow County, which is kind of that's Dark Horse, and that's sort of a Deep South horror in a way. If mm-hmm. if Southern Bastards is sort of like the Deep South crime book, then I would say Harrow County is sort of like the Deep South horror book about all the tall tales and things like that. And it's got a really wonderful ghost stories letter to the editor section in the back, which is fantastic, month in and month out. I probably read that more consistently than any other letters to the editor / writer essay.
Man, see, that like already gives me the creeps. Like, there's yeah. ghost stories in the back of that book, man.
Oh, my goodness. Sometimes they're scarier than the book itself, yeah.
Oh, my.
There's one about... No. His, no like, thanks. Grandpa was, like, walking by this house at night, and his motorcycle broke down, and so he goes into this abandoned church nearby, and someone's playing the piano inside, like,
oh,
off
God.
Tune, but he
Why
can't
are you
see
doing
who
this
it is. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anyway, like I said, it's really, really good. But I read that. I read The Disciples, which is sort of a deep space title, Deep Space Horror from Black Mask, which is sort of in the same vein as like Final Destination or the Dead Space games, where mankind expands to the edges of the universe and you start having all these isolated, you know, small colonies of people on planets that are, you know, 30 or 40 people just, you know, trying to make a living or whatever. And this senator on Earth hires these bounty hunters to bring back his daughter, who's been living on one of these planets where being all isolated and stuff has turned into like this weird cult surrounding the leader of that colony, and things have taken a weird, supernaturally, possibly Jim Jones sort of turn. And I think I described
Jim
it a little
Jones?
Bit. Jim Jones, you ever heard the phrase, drink the Kool-Aid?
Yeah.
Remember the guy who everybody drank the Kool-Aid and then...
Jonestown. Sorry, there we go. Okay.
Yeah.
Clicks in my head. Okay.
There you go.
Gotcha.
So that sort of cult thing going on, and I think I described it a little bit last week, but I read that. As you know, I obviously love the Alien Fire and Stone series.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and we can talk about this later, I think there are books that even you read, Mike, that are kind of horror, but they're more of a genre mashup in a way.
When you describe this, like, cosmic horror, I really love that. That's a great title. That reminds me of the Roach Limit that I've been reading. Like, Roach Limit, to me, in a way, is a combination of, like, a crime thriller slash supernatural horror slash cosmic horror, I guess. Not supernatural horror, cosmic horror. Because there is this level of cultists in space, and they're worshipping this giant demigod or black hole or whatever it is. And
Right. You
don't really get what it is completely. And even in Clandestine, the sequel series, or Roach Limit Clandestine, there's even more of that. So I guess I do read some horror books, so I don't know. But like you said, we could talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah, that the topic of cosmic horror is, I think, exactly the type of horror I really like, because in that instance, you never see exactly what the monster is, and that really leaves so much of it up to the imagination. And that's when you're actually, like, can be legitimately scared of things, because, like talking about Lovecraft, I mean, if you look at one of the old gods, then you go insane, like, forever. And
that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
That's it. Too bad. But in a way, it you brought up a good point when, James, when I think you led into this idea that it sort of feels, it's always very interesting to see how comic book writers and comic book artists approach the topic, especially sort of, I guess we can call it the pure topic or the topic of pure horror. It always seems like they're working with one arm tied behind their back, because they can't really scare you with sudden noises, and they can't really have things quote-unquote jump out at you. Things like that.
You mean those little sound effects that are like creak and crack in the bottoms of panels doesn't scare you at all?
Like, I think for me the closest thing to like a jump scare is when like everything seems normal and then they wait and then you flip the page and then all of a sudden, like the second you flip it, whatever it is just like some huge splash page of something absolutely messed up. But you're right. Mm-hmm. For the most part, it seems like horror would be more difficult to portray in comic books, at least in terms of the traditional creaky noises and you know, people that jump out and scare you, or all of a sudden, you know, some guy gets like a spear through the head or
But I wonder if to take a step back, I mean, comic books have a huge history of horror in them. Like, if you look at some very, very early comics, and I'm not going to say that I'm an expert
creepy
on any of this.
Creepy is pretty old, yeah.
Yeah, I just pulled out the archives at the library, actually. I was reading, like, the first 5 issues of Creepy. That was a really interesting one.
Yeah, and so, like, comic books have this huge history of horror comics, like, being the reason why there were a comics code back in the day, where people were like, we have to censor this, because it's really fucked up that little kids are reading these books about people with their faces melting off, you know? And the fact that those were so those were sold so well, I guess, or at least I assume they sold so well to the point where they had to ban them in some way, is like a testament to show that maybe it is just the imagery that people want, and it's not necessarily the jump scares that we associate with film, because that's a lot of our problem, I think, right here, is that we're associating a lot of what makes a horror comic book with what makes a horror film, and and they're two different aspects, because when we talk a little bit about like psychological horror in these comic books, or we talked a little bit about the pre-show, and I think James, you touched on it, about being scared, and Nick, you did too, about being scared of something bigger than you, something you can't conceive, and so you have to use your imagination. And that, to me, I think, is the definitive horror comic to you, like, or to anybody, is when you can't see it so well, or you can't see this item or this monster, or you can't perceive this thing, or when they finally draw it, it's so ridiculous that you kind of, it like nullifies the horror, because now you've actually seen it. So yeah, in some comic books they will show you a little bit of a monster, but I think that final reveal is the ultimate end of that horror, and or the end of the horror feeling, I guess, in that comic. So when you think about, for instance, Watchmen, right? That's the big thing. You know, Watchmen in the comic book has this giant, horrible tentacle monster thing that was going to destroy whatever, New York, or I don't remember the story, whatever. It's been that long since I read Watchmen, because it's a one and done, right? not really. But like they talk of like Ozymandias, you know, he builds up this monster over and over. At least he builds up what it could potentially be. And throughout the story, at least near the end of the story, you're kind of thinking, what could this be? Is he going to drop a nuke on New York? Is he going to do something to destroy the, you know, just the island, or what's going to happen? And it turns out to be this horrible monster, and it's the last thing you ever expected. And I think that's the great thing that comic books can do, and movies do this as well, but I think comic books do it better, where you can imagine anything, and what the artist actually puts on the page can never ever be equal on screen. I think they could never recreate that horrible monster on screen without it looking cheesy and dumb, whereas in the comic, since everything is already kind of cartoony, you just assume, well, that's just as real as the people that I'm looking at, that I'm, you know, relating to in this comic. So when you read a book like, say, Witches, which I haven't read, but you read a book like Witches, and from the preview that I read that scared the shit out of me, that I can't read the comic now, the implications of these witches and the horror that they're going to, you know, put on these people is enough to make me go, nope, not for me, and I walk away. I just lightly gallop away from the book and say, no thanks. So that's the one thing I guess you can appreciate about horror comics is what I'm trying to get at. Would you guys say that that's true, or are we just kind of rambling on the same point?
No, I think you're right. I think horror comics have had to find ways to scare people that don't really jive with the methods that are used in film. I definitely agree with you. I mean, as I was saying earlier, it seems like it's difficult to do those things, which is why they've had to resort to other methods. And I think comics, you find much more taking on sort of a thriller or a slow build atmospheric sense of terror, something more, I guess you would say, Silent Hill rather than Resident Evil, if you want to use comparisons, I guess.
Sure. weren't those both comic books at some point? I don't know.
Resident Evil is a manga, but Silent Hill is an IDW comic. That's correct.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Nick, historian, comic book historian guy.
You're welcome. but yeah, it seems like in a lot of ways, the more modern horror comics that we have, which is being a great example, the truly weird or horrific or outer worldly elements are not really seen. But what you end up encountering a lot are the evil that man does, in a way. What these outer worldly elements convince people, what it makes people capable of. And Lovecraft, very same idea. Like, there are obviously all these cults and whatnot that worship Cthulhu and all the other gods in Lovecraft, and it's not so much about the horror that the god brings upon people sometimes, as much as it is what he convinces or what he is able to persuade humanity to do to one another. And in Witches, you certainly see that, where the community is like, well, you know, they picked you, or someone picked you, or to use the terminology of Witches, someone pledged you. So that's that. And I think Harrow... Yeah, and it's bad, because, like, you don't have any say in it. Someone pledged you, and it's like, do I have any input in this? Is there, like, a set of paperwork that I can fill out to just get out of this? Because it doesn't seem that lucrative for me. And I think Harrow County is very similar, in the same way you've got this girl who is rumored to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, James, I think I've got this right. She's rumored to be the reincarnation or the return of this witch that they hung years and years ago. And so the community collectively, unspoken, but there's a collective understanding that they have to find a way to kill this girl at some point.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
So, and that...
Well, it becomes more of an issue once she starts actually demonstrating powers and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with Stephen King's It, which is the one with the clown and Tim Curry.
Pennywise.
Yeah. Yes. But I think that's actually an interesting tie-in here, because the creature It is literally a manifestation of fear. So whatever you're most afraid of, and it targets specifically children, that's what you see it as. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's a 1,200-page long book. It's way too long. I could talk all day. Yeah. I could talk all day about Stephen King tends to overwrite a bit, but most
Stephen
of the
King
book
always tends to make things turn out to be aliens.
Yes.
No.
That's true. God. That's true in this case. Spoiler alert.
Yes. Oh no! Whoa, we just ruined it.
Oh no!
That's all right. I don't care. You know what? It's been way too long. It's too long. There was a level of when was okay to spoil that movie, and it ended 20 years ago. So don't worry about
it. It's a big book. No one wants to read it. If you're interested in watching Tim Curry stuff, just go pick up Rocky Horror. Problem solved. Done.
Anyway, the point I was trying to make was that the most of the book is not even there. It's mostly all these characters who've been getting fucked up by it for their entire lives, and they're so messed up in the head that they end up like trying to murder off the kids who are trying to kill it because they are under this like bizarre impression that like they need to kill the kid and then it will leave them alone, blah blah blah. But there are several characters who it almost like almost to like a possession level controls them and forces them to do these terrible things. And I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of horror, is that you see, like, a serial murder or something on TV. You're like, I would never, ever be that person. But maybe if some crazy, horrific event happened, who's to say that you wouldn't become that person?
Right. You heard it right here, ladies and gentlemen. Let's keep this audio record for the file when James... No, I'm just kidding.
But do we? But you're, so what you're saying is that this is like a common trope in horror stories. And would you say that it works better in like a novel sense, or do you think it works better in comics?
I would say it's fairly common in comic books, and I'm not sure whether it translates better in a novel or a comic book, because the psychological aspect of things is definitely a literary device for me. At least, like, most of the horror that, or the scared feelings I get are from reading the text on the page. But the illustration definitely gives you, like, a definite direction to point your imagination, which I think can also be very valuable.
Gotcha. So to get back to a point, Nick, that we kind of downplayed earlier, you were saying something about how we mesh genres sometimes to add into horror. Like, and I said it, you know, with Roach Limit, I think that the story, there's like a cosmic horror aspect to that, and there's also, you know, there is an action adventure or mystery side to things. And usually we see a lot of books that have horror aspects to them, I guess.
I was just thinking of Nailbiter. You love Nailbiter. And yeah. Nailbiter, depending upon who you talk to, yeah, that's a horror book.
Yeah. But and I think that now that we've said it out loud and I actually started to think about it, I do read more quote-unquote horror books, but I don't label them so much as horror books because I think there's like a negative connotation when you say to someone, oh, here's a book, it's really, really good, it's got a really good story, and it's a horror book. And it'll immediately turn them off because horror is horror. You know, it's scary. It's something that maybe you don't want to put yourself through because you don't want to see someone get killed or maimed or sliced up or tortured or something like that, which are all these things that typically the heavy levels of violence are what we associate with horror. Even if a book is like a psychological horror, I mean, in the case of Nailbiter, they are actually killing people. It's all about serial killers. But in other cases, there might be stories that are considered horror, but it's all psychological. It's not necessarily killing, but it's just something bad is happening. So I guess my point is, like, do you think that genre mashing like this helps books, at least to sell them? I guess maybe I already answered the question, but I want to hear what you guys have to say.
Yeah, I would definitely say that there is a reason that in this modern day and age, it feels like genre-based comics are not really a thing anymore. You don't really hear about Western comics anymore, and at one point, those sold amazingly. You don't really hear about horror comics as much anymore. And to some extent, although this is maybe not as true anymore, you don't really hear about romance comics anymore. And yet, at certain points in time, and I might be a little bit off on this, but all of those were outselling superhero books at any given point in time.
Right.
I think if I recall correctly, it was right after World War II, romance was outselling superhero stuff like gangbusters, if I have it right. But and all of those and sort of crime noir and whatnot, you have all these different genres, and I think a lot of people and a lot of books are getting away from that because people just have an automatic association. You know, if you ask people what do they read, if they say fiction, I read fiction, well, that sounds instantly more respectable than, well, I read Westerns or, well, I read romance, because automatically people are thinking of those throwaway, you know, dime a dozen romance novels or those just cheap paperbacks that are written by hacks, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So people don't want that image, regardless of how good or bad those books actually are. And in comics, you're seeing a move towards, well, yes, it's horror, but it's also this. Or in the popular vernacular of comic books, it's this meets this, which means you absolutely have to love it. I did the math. You love it.
It's Preacher meets Saga in space. Like, I don't think so, man.
It's All-Star Western meets Batman meets Ghost Rider meets meets Doc Savage with a little bit of Phantom.
What if is that's happening? A book. No. Did you just describe Dynamite's 2016 lineup or something?
It's crime. It's that old character you love, plus that old character you love, plus that old character you love.
With a
it's
new all modern twist. Yeah.
But probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Dynamite. I do read like three or four of your books. I love Bob's Burgers, so. So I don't know how many of you are aware of this, listener-wise. I know Mike is quite familiar with this idea, but frequently I come up with articles and topics that seem quite out of left field.
Hundreds.
To the point that I think Mike starts vetting some of them to actually find out whether or not I've been registering domain names and creating fictional, creating pseudonyms and writing these all myself. Which, you know, might be true. Who knows? The shadow knows. Who knows what evil lies in the hearts of men? Anyway, that being said, I'm going to let you in on a little tip as to how I find some of these absolutely weird articles. And that's that occasionally I go to Google, I filter by news search, and I just type in comic books and see what really weird stuff rolls out.
Huh.
That's how you end up actually reading MTV articles about comic books. And on that note, I recently found an article that was celebrating Read Comics in Public Day, which was August 28th, which was that yesterday?
It was this past Friday.
That was Friday. And Read Comics in Public Day also coincides with Jack Kirby's birthday, which I think a lot of us, at least on Twitter for me, I saw so much more for it being Kirby's birthday than actual Read Comics in Public Day. But MTV threw together this article, or as I should say, it's a list that looks a lot like BuzzFeed.
Listicle is the proper term.
Yeah, is that, like, are people using that and being taken seriously?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. This listicle is called 13 Fantastic Comic Books You Should Absolutely Not Read in Public. So let's be clear, because I think we all got a little confused at first. These books are not bad. They're good, apparently, but you don't want to read them in public, I guess. And it started a discussion for me, sort of an internal dialogue about, geez, you know, sometimes I like to read books when I'm at the library or just sitting around at the coffee shop, and I've at least had moments. One that very much comes to mind was I was reading Zero, and I had never read Zero before. I knew it was kind of violent, and I knew it was Image, and maybe right there that should have been enough of a clue. But I started reading Zero in public, and I started coming upon some very, very, very questionable material, the likes of which would have taken a lot of explaining away. But thankfully, I quickly closed the book, looked around, and at that point, people probably figured out that something was going on. But have you guys had these moments where you're just out and about and you're reading something, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, I didn't know this book was going here. Or on the flip side, I actually had an idea it might go here, and here it is, and that's whatever. Deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Sex Criminals is one that kind of stands out, just because it raises
some
interesting questions.
I'm glad I don't have to explain away that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
People look at the title and they see the picture and they see, oh my goodness, I can't even imagine. Go on. Let's hear this.
Yeah, I mean, you can only imagine what a sex criminal would be, and out of context, I think you assume the worst, and that they're not just like mostly good guys looking out for themselves, you know.
Right. You are what you read. No.
Yeah.
What about you, Mike? Have you had a situation where you've been flipping through the pages of something and suddenly realized that it was not fit for all ages?
Well, yes. Sex criminals is one, but I do usually don't read that in public. I think the biggest one that I've had a strange look from was, I mean, I get my comics at Midtown, and you know I ride the train home every day. And so I usually read like one or two comics depending on if I find a seat on the train. And most days I do, especially on Wednesdays because I'll get out of work late and blah, blah, blah. So I pick up only a handful of books in physical format now. So it's like East of West and Sex Criminals and Saga and Archie and Fight Club 2, It Will All Hurt, just a handful of them. And one that I do pick up is Sex by Joe Casey, published by Image. Now, right away, just like Sex Criminals, it's kind of got a provocative title, and the covers on this book, while not explicit, are very, well, I think the word is they imply. I guess the phrase is they imply a lot sometimes. So, there, for instance, there was a cover where the guy standing naked, but he didn't have a penis and testicles. Instead, he had a gun with two grenades, you know. You know, whatever you want to take away from that, maybe that guy actually has a gun for a dick, we don't know. But nonetheless, the covers are a little bit explicit, and the content is incredibly explicit. It has a mature reader's like thing on it. It says you shouldn't read this. You shouldn't read this if you're under 18, I guess, or you're, you know, not the type of person who's of that age to read things like that. So reading that book on the train is a little problematic. I usually, if I know I have that book, I usually try to find a seat in the corner and read it to myself. But, you know, I really don't shame away holding up a comic while I'm reading it, especially, you know, if I'm reading a book like Archie or even Saga, for instance, I'll pick that up because the covers for those books are usually pretty straightforward, and Archie is nowhere near being offensive inside or outside, whereas Saga has very beautiful covers, but a lot of the time the content on the inside is either violent or maybe sexual in nature and maybe not okay for little kids, and there are little kids on these trains, so sometimes I feel a little bit weird. But I can't think of a specific time where I felt weird about a comic, whereas I do have a story about the time I was watching a movie on a plane, but maybe, essentially, I don't remember what movie it was, but there was an explicit sex scene for like 2 minutes, like movies do, and I was sitting next to a four-year-old and his mom, and the mom was right next, or the mom was on the outside, and the little kid was in the middle, and I was next to the window, and I was just like, oh, this is happening in this movie, and I just turned as far away without being, I mean, it was incredibly awkward looking, but I was like holding my hands over my phone, watching this movie on my phone, and I was like, oh, when's this gonna be done? I realize this is important to the story, but and in comic books, it's even tougher though to hide those types of things because one, comic books are much bigger than a phone, for instance, and two, the images are still. It's not like in a second this scene could be over and no one would be the wiser. It's like no, if you're still reading that page and people are having sex or there's a dude with his dick out, like. That's there to you turn the page, man. And if you're a slow reader, there's a lot of text. It's there. It's all hanging out. So
that's when you turn to the mom and you're like, he's not old enough to read anyway, so it's not like he's figured it out. But I know, that's the joke.
That's the funniest thing is it's explicit imagery, not necessarily explicit, you know, wording. Because like, fuck, shit, balls, dick, whatever, you're going to see that printed in text, but you'd have to actually be trying to read the comic to find that, whereas if you see any of those words that I just described in pictures, it's a little bit more obvious what's going on. So, I don't know. I don't. Part of me is like, you shouldn't be ashamed of reading comics, but then you wonder, is there like a social obligation to hide these things? And I think that comes down to every person's specific, you know, social moral code or whatever, which right. asks, you know. So I guess the question is, like, do you guys, the bigger question is, Read Comic Book Day, you know, was created specifically to say it's not shameful to be reading comic books in public. So I guess the question is, do you guys still feel a little ashamed of reading comics, or are you proud to be able to sit outside or in public reading a comic book, despite the content, just to say, you know, if you're reading X-Men or if you're reading Sex Criminals, like, do you like being out in the open and being recognized, I guess, as being reading comics? As a person reading comics, I should say.
Well, at least in the Grand Rapids area, I feel like it's a pretty liberal area, and I don't think people really have that kind of prejudice towards comic books that some people do, but in other places that I've lived, I've definitely felt kind of odd reading comic books, just kind of like people maybe don't think that you're spending your time super constructively, like you could be reading like a real book instead of a comic book. And
ooh,
definitely
that's
like
the problem right there. Definitely real book like versus comic book. That's that shit enrages me. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's an issue I get just like talking with my relatives or whatever. I tell them about how many comic books I read and they're like, "Why don't you just like read literature and then you'd like improve yourself?" I'm like, "Well, comic books
well, I don't
want to
do that, so
comic books do that too, just in a different way. I mean,
it's
these
still
haven't
literature.
Been around for it's still literature, absolutely, and they bring up interesting topics that make me, you know, question all my beliefs and everything. I mean, not everyone, but some of them definitely challenge me.
And that's the point of a good comic, I think. I mean, I don't know, Nick, do you have this issue in where you're living?
Yeah. So first off, I just want to point this out before I forget, because you brought up some examples and I also brought up some, and I think it's really interesting that, for example, if you're on a plane, and I don't even know if they do this anymore, but you know, there used to be like the in-flight movie, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think they've done away with that nearly completely, right? It's you have your own screen and you pick what you want to watch.
I think it depends on the flight, but yeah.
Sure, sure. So the idea being with the in-flight movie, we're going to have a movie. You can watch it or not, although it's obviously going to be there. So if you want to avoid it, good luck. But for some weird reason, like your in-flight movie, I mean, usually it's not like R, for example, but it can be PG-13. So they're more than okay with like subjecting you to the content of a PG-13 film, right? And apparently there's like no social issues or ramifications with that. That's socially permissible. And on the same level, and I think we've all probably seen this, it's a throwaway example, but it's nonetheless valid. People of all ages, whatever, reading 50 Shades of Grey on the train, on the bus, whatever, and none of us have any sort of misconceptions about the content of that book, right? So we have people, you know, we have like the airline that's perfectly okay showing you this movie with this content, and it's there, you know, it's probably even more in your face than someone reading a comic book. And you have people that are reading prose where you can't actually see it, but for the most part, especially with something like 50 Shades of Grey, we know that that book is probably rivaling most comic books and going, you know, five steps beyond that. And both of those things are seen as socially permissible and not a problem. But for some weird reason, when it's a comic book, all of a sudden you're not exempt in the way that those other two are, which I find very odd. But to answer your question about you know, being in Southwest Michigan and reading comics in public, yeah, I won't lie, I'm a little careful about what I choose to read in public, and as we talked about before, it sucks because. And this is, wow, what a first world problem. But I don't want to feel like I have to just read the big two in public, because that usually only reinforces people's ideas of what comics are. Oh, wow, here's a guy in cape. Here's a guy with a cape. Here's a guy wearing tights. You know, why don't you read quote-unquote real books, as James pointed out. But you also, at least for me, I want to be careful that I'm not reading something like Zero, or there's definitely Southern Bastards would be a great example of a book that I am not in any hurry to read in public. I mean, I guess I could like screen it, but it's like I'm not gonna flip through my book and potentially ruin things just to make sure I can take it outside with me or
well, plus
or
with that title,
wherever.
With that title, I mean, yeah. Like it kind of has this negative connotation to it initially, just like sex or sex criminal. Like you've got a curse word on the cover of your comic book. Oh no.
Right, and that's even worse, because if you're reading something like Saga, for example,
yeah.
The cover might not be suggestive. Heck, it might even be very artistic, and the title of the book itself is not really indicative of anything questionable in nature. But of course, there are books out there like Southern Bastards or Sex Criminals where even if the person is just staring at you, watching it from across the, watching you read it from across the room, you might already be getting some sort of a weird look at some point.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and heaven forbid someone actually comes up to you and says, "Could you not read that in public?" Like, I don't know if I've ever had someone actually come up and say anything like that to me before, where they were like, "I can't believe you're reading this," or. Or, you know, could you please stop reading this in front of my child or anything like that? So I can't necessarily speak to it. But I mean, what would you, I don't know. I guess the question is, what would you guys do if someone came up to you and they happened to glance over your shoulder and see the content, despite what the book is? Say they saw someone getting shot in the face in a comic book as they glanced over your shoulder and they were said, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe you're reading that in public." I mean, what do you think you would do in a situation like that? Well, I'll just put you guys on the spot for a second.
Yeah, it's a great question, especially because, I mean, a lot of the books I'm talking about are my own personal books I'm just carrying around, but most of the stuff you can get in a library. So in the same vein, someone could be persecuting you just because you picked a book off of a shelf that the library has apparently deemed something that they at least want to buy.
Right.
And you're just reading it, and for some reason that's enough. It's a tough question. I would probably try to explain the merits of it and go on for about 6 or 7 minutes until the guy just got bored and was like, "Wow, okay, I get it." I don't need a philosophical treatise on things, but
see, in that scenario, I think I would react the same way. But what if it's like a mother who's concerned about their child seeing that image and perhaps scarring their child? Would you respond differently in that instance?
Right, and that's a good question.
Yeah, let's put us all obviously, in this incredibly think, socially awkward
yeah,
place.
Like. Yeah, yeah, and she's staring at you, and she doesn't look that happy, and the kid is clearly looking at it in a way that it's going to socially, you know...
yeah, let's go into this hypothetical.
Warp him for the rest of his life.
Go deep. Build the scenario. Give me a background on all these characters, please.
Right, yeah. But the obvious solution there is, well... How are we in a position where you are consistently looking at the book I'm reading? I mean, right. I guess if someone's like sitting behind you on the bus or something and the kid's looking over the shoulder, I don't know. Otherwise, it's like, well, here's an idea. How about you not directly stare over my shoulder? Because this is a book, no different than any other book. I realize there are pictures, and some of them are not meant for children. But that's no different than prose,
right?
In a way, and I realize the real me might just flat out panic and close the book and leave. But
calm, cool, collected, Nick, right now.
Calm,
says
cool,
Otherworlds.
Calm, cool. Otherwise. I'll tell you what I'd do. Right. I'd tell you what I'd do. Yeah. That Nick, no.
What I'm trying to get at here is it's like there's still this very negative connotation towards comics, regardless of the content, right? If people see you reading a superhero story where the Punisher's shooting someone in the face, I'm just going to keep going back to that, you know, you could still get someone saying, "Oh, I don't read this in public, don't read this around my kid, I don't want you to, you know, this offends me in some way, you know," and... Regardless, someone may be looking down at you just for reading a comic book in general. And obviously, Read Comics in Public Day is set there to try to prevent this negative connotation. And yet, I feel like it still exists. Like, it's waning, but it is still there. And so, we as, you know, dedicated comic book people, you know, should we be doing something about this? Should we just continue to keep reading our comics in public and say, you know, this is a normal thing, there's nothing wrong with this, I'm not ashamed of this?
Well, I think after today... I'm going to have to take my Brian O'Malley variant of Sex Criminals number 11. I think I'm going to have to just take that to the library and be like, "You know what? This is what I'm about. And if you have a problem with that, you can go somewhere else."
Like the library, like not the library you work at.
Oh my gosh. Okay, that answers
next
it. That
week
answers
we'll
it.
Be podcasting live from the Kent County Jail.
And at the end of the day, like I said, you should just read comics. You really should just read comics. Read them in public, read them at your house. Just read them. That's the important thing here.
If you're reading Sex Criminals and someone gives you a weird, you know, look, just wink and nod.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Kanye, Cities of Eve, 20 Sil, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep up with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you'd like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecybe.org. Also, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter @destroythecybe and follow us on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And as always, thank you for listening.